Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biayo on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Monday, November 20th, 2023. The governor of Darfur says armed groups in the region have joined the Sudan conflict to protect civilians.
The position is not necessarily we are supporting one part against others. Our position is really that is, you know, the moral ground that we have to maintain our protections of our people.
And the United Nations distributes seeds to farming households in Sudan.
Managed to distribute over 10,000 of certified seed, mainly sorghum, millet, and a small amount of sesame. The distribution of it will reach over 1 million smallholder farmers.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We begin in Darfur, where two Darfur-based armed movements, which were previously observing from the sidelines of Sudan's conflict between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, have now chosen to actively engage in combat against what they call perpetrators of atrocities against civilians in Darfur. In an exclusive interview, I spoke with Darfur Governor Minni Minnawi, who is also the leader of one of these armed groups, the Sudan Liberation Movement / Army, to discuss the implications of this decision and its potential impact on the ongoing seven-month conflict in Sudan.
A lot of atrocities against the human rights happening there, including the ethnic cleansing and including other things happening in Darfur, and selective killing and eliminating of the people and everything of the, you know, tribal leaders by selection. Not the selection in the ethnicity. That is why we say we will not accept that one, and we will enter to the war against this atrocity and against whoever committing this atrocity. And that is who is doing that and who is making that kind of atrocity to us, RSF. But the position is not necessarily we are supporting one part against others. Our position is really that is, you know, the moral ground that we have to maintain our protections of our people. We have to reject any kind of atrocity.
Thank you very much for clarifying that, because when you had the press conference along with the Honorable Jibril Ibrahim and also leader of the Justice and Equality Movement, the news was that you are joining the fighting on the side of the army to fight the RSF. The conflict in Sudan has been going on for more than 7 months. Your forces stood on the sidelines and watched Darfur fall to RSF town after town. You saw crimes being committed against civilians in what human rights observers call ethnic targeting. You saw the governor of West Darfur killed in a Jenina. Why join now? Is it not too late?
The matter is joining. It is not because of, taking fight against other or supporting fight against other. This is what I told you. We form so-called joint forces from the movements. And these joint forces, it has the limited capacity. They had worked in Darfur and in very difficult circumstances. They have not good any except the enough logistic. They have no the capacity of the fighting. They are very limited numbers. These are the armed movements. These are not the government movements. Even the governor who killed, he was protecting by his armed movement. These armed movements, they are not equipped as the government forces. They are not taking anything from the government, and that is why we were joint forces, and that joint forces, it was securing the humanitarian convoy from Kosi, about the 1,000 kilometers up to Darfur. They were securing all the vital areas in Bashir, in Niala. They were securing even the humanitarian basis of the organizations and NGOs and UN offices and so on. They were doing a lot of things, and still we are doing. The matter of joining to the fight, it is not easy to join the fight, those like, you know, to protect the people from those who have, you know, equipped from the country, and they are very well equipped, and also they are still supported by the countries and they funded and so on.
And now you have joined. What is your plan for protection of civilians? Since you say this is your major focus, is not to fight against the RSF.
I'm talking according of our capacities. Up to now, I'm talking according of our capacity. When we are anywhere, they come and attack, we will protect the place. When we saw any atrocities in front of our eyes, we will prevent that one. When they attack us, also we will protect ourselves. I think this is the way that we are going to do it.
We saw this directive from General Burhan, the commander-in-chief of Sudan's armed forces and the head of the country's sovereign council, approving $300 million US dollars for your forces and other forces joining the fight. It says the joint forces requested this huge sum. Can you confirm this directive is correct, and how do you justify it?
That is fake paper. I believe from the RSF or somewhere they built that paper. It was not true. We never got any money or any dollar from General Burhan. But if we got it, that is our right. We are Sudanese, that is our right. But unfortunately we didn't have any money from General Burhan. And even General Burhan never signed any paper. That is fake paper. It's just published by the people that they want to, you know, advertise the fakeness.
That's Darfur Governor and leader of the Sudan Liberation Movement / Army, Mini Minawi. He spoke with me via a satellite line from the Eritrean capital of Asmara in the past hour. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says it has distributed seeds to 5 million people in Sudan to enable them to produce their own food. FAO says the outbreak of conflict in April pushed nearly half of the population into a humanitarian crisis, adding that the seed distribution is intended to enable farmers to produce enough food for their families and to meet the cereal needs for between 13 and 19 million people. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Adam Yao, the deputy representative of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, says millions of people in Sudan are food insecure.
We know that in Sudan, over 25 million people need humanitarian assistance. 20 million people are in high acute food insecurity. Out of the 20.3 million people who are in acute food insecurity, over 60 million are in IPC scale 2, which means that they are in crisis situation. If they need food, they need to deplete the essential assets to have access to food. Another over 6 million are on IPC scale 4, which is just one step away from famine.
Yao says FAO is focusing on providing sustainable support rather than direct food assistance. He says FAO distributed certified seeds, including lentils, sorghum, sesame, and millet, to vulnerable small-scale farmers in 15 states across Sudan.
We managed to distribute over 10,000 tons of certified seeds, mainly sorghum, millet, and a small amount of sesame. The distribution of FAO reached over 1 million smallholder farmers in 15 states in Sudan. You know that Sudan has 18 states. The states that were not targeted because they had to reach states are the Darfur state, West Darfur, South Darfur. Normally we don't target that too because it is a city.
The FAO official says he believes distributing seeds to farming households will enable them to produce their own food for both consumption and the market.
Our projection is that they will be able to produce between 2 and 3 million tons of sorghum. And that will be a tremendous result. It will also contribute to consolidate the food and nutrition security in Sudan, especially during the ongoing crisis.
FAO says farmers are facing several other challenges, including a lack of seeds, tools, finance, and extension services. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
Uganda's new license plate tracking surveillance system has raised concerns about privacy rights and freedom of association expression, according to a report by Human Rights Watch. The system allows the government to track the locations of all registered vehicles in real time, including foreign cars temporarily in the country. Human Rights Watch urges the government to scrap the system, saying it risks individual rights. Additionally, vehicle owners must pay a registration fee to obtain new plates with tracking devices provided by Uganda Telecommunications Corporation Limited. For more insight, VOA's Pauline Diho via Skype spoke with Oriom Nyeko, the author and Uganda researcher at Human Rights Watch.
Human Rights Watch, this past week, we put out a statement talking about Uganda's new, what they're calling the Intelligent Transport Monitoring System, which is basically a surveillance system that has been introduced in the country that includes attaching tracking devices to the number plates of every vehicle in the country. The owners of private vehicles are going to be required to register anew for these new number plates in February next year. That is going to allow the government to track their location in real time at all times.
That's scary for a lot of people, especially people who own private cars. If these were government cars, I would say sure. But you're looking at invasion of privacy here.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it poses several risks to people's to the restriction of people's right to privacy. I mean, the authorities knowing or having the ability to locate where every vehicle is at a given time is very risky.
There are people who said that perhaps this is not a new thing. This has been going on with, of course, the introduction of the CCTV cameras that came back a couple years ago. In Kampala, you have cameras all over the streets. So there are people who argue that this is not a new thing. It's been going on, and it's a way of Uganda trying to make sure that its citizens, its people are protected.
The government has been steadily increasing its capacity to surveil the population, first with the introduction of those CCTV cameras that you mentioned. But now they're adding to it with the number plates, and they're also adding new cameras, they say, that will have the capacity to do facial recognition and also recognize other elements in vehicles like the number plates.
Would it be fair to say, for example, I've been to countries, even here in the United States where I am, there is surveillance all over the place. Once you buy a car, it's registered in the system. Everybody knows if police stops you, they can easily pull up your record and make reference, connect your address to the ownership of the car. Now, how is this that I'm describing different from what we have in Uganda?
Yeah, it's true. Most countries in the world surveil people in some way or the other. And the difference in this particular case is that Uganda is taking it a step further by adding these tracking devices. There's no other country in the world that has the capacity to track every single vehicle in the country. It's important when we talk about surveillance to remember that the right to privacy is a right, of course, that like most rights can be inhibited in some way, but it has to be done in a way when it is strictly necessary, or alternatively where the surveillance matches the issue, the risk that is trying to be addressed. In this particular case, that doesn't apply. The risk that we are trying to that the government is trying to address just doesn't match the limitations on people's rights to privacy.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Oriem Nyeko, a Uganda researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking to VOA's Pauline Diho. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, we look at efforts to help release Israeli hostages kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th. Stay tuned for that story right after this break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. U.S. and Israeli officials say there are ongoing negotiations to help release the hostages kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th. But Israeli officials refuse to give details due to what they say is the sensitive nature of the negotiations. This following reports of a possible deal that will lead to the release of the hostages to their families. Meanwhile, South Africa has officially referred Israel to the International Criminal Court over allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity. This as the ruling party also backs calls for a parliamentary measure to close down the Israeli embassy in South Africa. For the latest developments about the negotiations and the war between Israel and Hamas, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Ilan Levi via Skype. He is a spokesperson for the Israeli government. He is part one of that conversation.
I'm not going to comment live on air about sensitive negotiations. You'll understand that human lives are hanging in the balance. 240 hostages, including over 30 children, including 10 toddlers under the age of five. That's a 10-month-old baby who is now being held hostage by Hamas in a dark tunnel somewhere. So we hope to get them home. We're doing everything we can to bring them home. And the less we say, the better, and the more likely we will be to secure their release.
Well, Israel says it has uncovered a Hamas command center, tunnels and ammunition at the Shifa Hospital. Some of the doctors are denying, and Hamas is also dismissing the finds. What's the Israeli government's reaction to these denials?
Look, the fact that Hamas denies it is not surprising. Hamas denies that it perpetrated the atrocities of October 7th. Hamas denies that it took civilians hostage. Hamas denies that its fighters have been killed. Hamas denies everything, okay? Hamas is not a credible source for anything. Now, as for the doctors inside the hospital, you have to understand, perhaps they're good people. I don't dispute that. But they are living under an authoritarian regime. Hamas is an authoritarian regime that dictates what people are allowed to say freely. And they know that they are not free to speak freely. And so whether or not those doctors are supporting Hamas, and the evidence shows that actually Hamas enjoys vast support among the Palestinian public, those doctors are not free to speak their minds. So the fact that they're not telling us, look, there's a Hamas compound in the basement, is not surprising. What I can confirm, we are revealing the evidence, we're exposing the evidence. This isn't the Wizard of Oz that we can pull back a curtain and say, ta-da, here is the whole vast Hamas tunnel complex. They've spent 16 years building these headquarters. They've had a month to prepare for us coming, and we will peel back the evidence and present it for the whole world to see.
Some Israelis, I'm told, are calling for the prime minister to resign because of what is going on. Are those calls legitimate, and what has been his reaction so far?
First of all, the Israeli public is right to be extremely angry about the failure that led to the October 7th massacre. This was the greatest tragedy in our country's history. And the prime minister has said that after the war, after we win this war, after Hamas is defeated, everyone is going to have to give the Israeli public answers, including him. Everyone will have to take responsibility. Everyone will be accountable. But for now, the prime minister says we're focusing on the questions that will help us prosecute and win this war. And that is the mission that we are focusing on now.
Well, Mr. Levi, there are calls by some in the international community for Israel to end its military offensive ongoing at the moment. What is Jerusalem saying about this?
In one word, no. There will be no end to the fighting that leaves our hostages in Gaza and Hamas in power. We will not go back to 6 in the morning on October 7th. We will not go back to a world in which Hamas can decide whenever it wants to invade Israel's villages, burn whole families alive, torture children in front of their parents, mutilate parents in front of their children, to rape little girls, to abduct our grandmothers, to behead babies. We will not go back to that world. There is only one way that this war can end, and that is with the total destruction of Hamas's military and governing capabilities in the Gaza Strip so that Gaza can never pose a security threat to Israel. And as for the international community, we know that we have the good nations of the world behind us. The United States stands shoulder to shoulder with us, that the goal of this war must be the total destruction of Hamas. The Prime Minister of the UK has also said the UK wants Israel to win this war because they understand that the world is only safe when terrorists know that they cannot get away with committing such barbaric atrocities, when they know that if they try to hurt populations in democratic countries, those countries will come after them and will wipe those terrorists off the face of the earth. And that's exactly what we're going to do to Hamas. We're going to hunt every single monster involved in the October 7th massacre. We will bring them to justice and we will make them pay.
That's Ilan Levi, a spokesperson of the Israeli government. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Cloti. Some environmentalists and activists calling for reduced plastic pollution say talks in Kenya to set up the world's first treaty to curb plastic pollution did not make nearly enough progress. Helen Kahaso-Dena, Pan-African Plastic Project lead for Greenpeace Africa, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme the talks that ended last night drew more than 500 proposals from governments, but negotiators did not strike a deal.
The PAD, intergovernmental negotiating committee, really ended on a disappointing note, simply because countries failed to agree on the intersessional work that is supposed to happen between now and the ANC4 in Canada. And most of these oil and gas producing countries were dictating the terms of, you know, the negotiations. They were negotiating in bad faith. At the beginning of the week, there was this, low ambition or, self-proclaimed countries, Saudi Arabia, Iran, basically just oil producing countries. And they really, want to prioritize, downstream measures as opposed to upstream measures. So as at yesterday, when the meeting ended, really there was no agreement in terms of some of the institutional work that was going to go ahead.
Why is plastic such a concern worldwide? I mean, what is the harm of discarded plastics, especially in Africa?
Plastic is, very toxic. It pollutes the environment, but more than that, it also impacts on human health. We know that it's a triple planetary crisis. So we're talking of impacts on climate crisis, but also biodiversity loss and pollution. But more than that, studies have shown that there are microplastics in the air that we breathe, in the water that we drink, and some have even been found in, a bloodstream of human beings. So we are not just talking about, negative impacts on the environment, but also on our own health. And for Africa specifically, Africa is not really a major producer of plastics, but still bears the brunt when it comes to, the impact of plastic pollution. Africa also has the added burden of, plastic waste dumping, what has now come to be popularly known as waste colonialism. So we see countries from the global north scrambling to dump plastic waste into Africa and turn Africa into a dumpster.
So did the leaders that were attending this meeting agree to anything?
Of course, the other stuff that they agreed on, things like, waste management, all of them are agreed. So the real contentious issue here is, a reduction in production, because when you speak about things like the primary plastic polymers, that's where the core of the issue is, because they do not want to reduce, production on that. But you see, if the treaty in itself is supposed to deal with plastic pollution, but you cannot deal with pollution without looking at how do you cut production, how do you reduce production. That's where the bone of contention is.
What is your message to oil-producing countries and, this idea of corporate capture of plastic pollutants?
For oil-producing countries, really, they should not put profit before people and the planet, because this is not just about profit. They're actually looking at their own interests versus the interests of the other, you know, the environment, but also the health of human beings.
That's Helen Kahaso-Dena, Pan-African Plastic Project Lead for Greenpeace Africa, who attended the talks. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme in Nairobi. And that's all we have for you this Monday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Ras Corby and the song Jamila. Been listening to Ras Corby, and rather the song is called Belet Jadid. I'm your host, Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Adrias Regis, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The fourth Thursday in November is Thanksgiving in the United States, a national holiday celebrating the first anniversary of the establishment of one of the earliest permanent English colonies in North America. On November 11, 1620, the ship Mayflower, carrying 102 settlers who came to be known as Pilgrims, arrived at the shores of North America. They were the first of a group of religious separatists who refused to follow the teachings of the Church of England, a punishable offense in their native country. So they made the decision to leave Europe and establish a farming village in the northern part of the Virginia colony, which had been settled 13 years earlier. Accidentally landing nearly 1,000 kilometers too far north, they nevertheless decided to stay, finally settling on a spot a little south of today's city of Boston in the state of Massachusetts. There they founded Plymouth Colony. That first year in North America was very difficult. Although they were not starving, thanks in part to support from the local native population of the Wampanoag people, within the first 2 months, two-thirds of them died. But the fall of 1621 brought plentiful crops, and as the end of the harvest coincided with the anniversary of their arrival in North America, the Pilgrims celebrated. 53 settlers sat down to a feast with 90 of their Wampanoag neighbors, dining on wild fowl, venison, and a variety of vegetables. But first came heartfelt prayers, thanking God for his forbearance, which allowed them to survive. This American spirit of gratitude dates back to our earliest days, when the Pilgrims celebrated a successful first harvest, thanks to the generosity and support of the Wampanoag people, said President Joe Biden. It inspired George Washington to give his troops a day of prayer and thanks amid fierce fighting for American independence. It also moved Abraham Lincoln to proclaim Thanksgiving a national holiday, honoring America's bounty and asking God to bring us together to care for one another and heal our nation. Today, Thanksgiving is still all about family and food. holiday dinner still features autumn vegetables, but instead of venison and wild fowl, the feast centers on a roasted turkey. This Thanksgiving, as homes across America fill with laughter, favorite family foods, and the joy of friends and relatives reuniting, said President Biden, we give thanks for everything that is good in our lives and reflect on the many blessings of our nation.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.